From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're taking a listen back to 2022 and revisiting some of the most important conversations this year. We're devoting much of the hour to a company that touches 40% of Californians with a troubled history. PG&E is the largest utility company in the country, with customers spanning just south of the Oregon border to Bakersfield, and has been blamed for more than 30 wildfires since 2017, destroying thousands of homes and killing more than 100 people. The utility giant also provides natural gas, emerging from federal probation from the deadly San Bruno gas explosion in 2010. Since becoming CEO in January of 2021, Patti Poppe has promised to overhaul not just the system of PG&E, but also the culture. Back in August, I spoke with Poppe about, in her words, getting out of disaster response and moving to disaster prevention. Patti, you're about a year and a half into this position as CEO of PG&E, and you came as president of a utility company in Michigan. You have a background in engineering. I'm curious, with that experience that you bring, what was your outside perspective of PG&E before even considering leading one of the largest utility companies in the country?
Yeah, you know, the utility industry is very connected to one another. We have very transparent relationships because we're not directly competing for customers. We share a lot of best practices. And so I had observed for a long time the challenges affecting California, Northern Central California in particular, and the PG&E service area and the company PG&E. And certainly knew that there was a big opportunity here to transform the operations, to transform the way that we both serve customers and deliver clean energy to the ambitions of the people of California. And so I was both a little daunted by the challenge. It seemed like it was going to be a big turnaround, was going to really be required, but I have a background in turnarounds. And so that was sort of up my alley. But what was really exciting was the idea to lead the clean energy transition here in California is just a great opportunity. Mm-hmm.
I want to set up some key challenges you were set to inherit. Just months prior to becoming CEO, PG&E emerged from bankruptcy. A fire victim trust was created for 70,000 wildfire victims as far back as 2015, including the Tubbs Fire, which killed 22 people, and the Camp Fire, which claimed at least 84 lives. I covered both of those wildfires. Not to mention, still under federal probation for the 2010 San Bruno natural gas explosion, which killed 8 people. What interested you about the job?
Well, I will tell you, as I watched from afar the wildfire coverage, and I had known about the San Bruno coverage and incident. In fact, the San Bruno incident transformed the entire industry in our gas safety practices. I knew that the people of California needed better, and I knew that we could be better. I, you know, was running a very successful utility that was very customer centric and focused on quality delivery. I, you know, am very close with people running other utilities who really do a great job for customers. And I knew that it was possible. In fact, one time the recruiter said to me, "Patti, now you just know it's a utility. You know how to run a utility." And so, though the challenges have been, I'd say, longstanding, I think the fundamentals of staying close to our customers, being customer-driven, have an operations mindset was going to work at PG&E. And we can already see sort of the small signs of progress that we're already experiencing.
Yeah. When you started in January of 2021, I believe you were the third CEO and fifth, including interim CEOs, within a roughly 4-year period. Some would say that that is a very fast revolving door. What sets you apart?
Well, I came to stay, number one. Certainly, I knew that this would be a long-term commitment, that we had a lot of work to do. It didn't get here overnight. We weren't going to turn it around overnight, but that I made a commitment to my team that I lead that I was here till we made it right and made it safe. And as long as the people of California will have me, I'll keep doing what we're doing here to really turn around PG&E and make it the company that customers can be proud and thankful for the service they receive.
When you first arrived as CEO and started doing, you know, a forensic analysis of what to improve upon, what stood out to you?
You know, some fundamental building blocks of great operations comes from transparency of performance on a daily basis, what I call the heartbeat of improvement, that every day we're committed to doing better than we did yesterday. But there's some basic operating tools that we could deploy. So we've implemented our lean operating system. And so that's, we've got some fundamentals that we're teaching the organization about how great operations are run. That's a big piece. And the other piece was making PG&E more local. You know, a utility like ours is at its best when we are closest to our customers, who happen to be our friends, our families, and our neighbors. You know, we're not shipping stuff over to, I don't know, Massachusetts. We're delivering products to our neighbors. And so we took the company and broke it into 5 regions with the intent of creating a more local feel. We call that a regional service model. It allows us to get closer to the unique needs. California is diverse. You know, we serve from basically Oregon down to Bakersfield. I like to say Bernie to Bakersfield. We have the opportunity to show up in a local way. The Bay Area has different needs than the Central Valley, than the South Coast, than the Northern Sierras. It's just a different service need, and we should show up relevant to those local communities. So our regional service model is already underway, and we can feel it making a real difference in those local communities.
I read that you're also a PG&E customer and that onboarding didn't go as planned.
Vicki, yes, I suppose I should tell that story. Yeah, when I signed up for service, and my husband took the marker to do that, he signed us up for service, and it turned out something went wrong in the sign-on process. And not too long after we moved in, one of my coworkers showed up to shut us off because we hadn't signed up for gas service. We had signed up for electric, but not gas. So that was a window into customer experience, customer orientation, and it was a great opportunity for me to meet our coworkers and learn a little more about our process. And every time something like that happens, Vicki, I groan like, oh my goodness. But then I think, well, okay, that's one more thing we can fix, and that'll make a difference for customers. And so we're going to be on a journey of continually improving the experience for our customers. We talk about it every day, and we work on it every day. And I can already feel the seeds of change in how things are happening for our customers.
Did the challenges that you were prepared for, did it exceed your expectations? Because within the first year, the Dixie Fire was sparked by PG&E equipment. Months later, a winter storm blew out power to tens of thousands across the Sierra foothills for weeks. What did those disasters teach you?
I would say that what I know about running a great utility is that challenges do happen. And in fact, there are times when a utility is at its best in a crisis. My goal is to get us out of sort of disaster response and get us into the disaster prevention business. And it's a different orientation for the team. And so I can't say that it was surprising per se, but it was definitely daunting, like the seriousness of what we do. It's one thing when you have an outage, you know, across the country, and at my previous utility, when we had an outage, yes, that was all hands on deck. Everybody worked to restore, and it was very important. But we didn't have to worry that a wildfire was going to start every time the wind blew. And so the seriousness of our challenge is borne by all of us. We definitely feel that every day. When I lay my head on the pillow at night and I can hear the wind blowing outside, I have a different feeling than I used to about the seriousness of it. In fact, I'll tell you a quick story, Vicki. We have one of our board members is a former four-star admiral in the U.S. Navy. He was the chief naval officer for, again, the U.S. Navy. He's on our board of directors. And I called him one Saturday because I wondered to myself, who else would understand the seriousness of this mission, like the life and death aspects of this mission? And of course, my admiral friend. So I called Admiral Ferguson and I asked him for his advice. And he said, oh, Patty, I should have given you this talk months ago. I give it to all my young commanders. And I'm like, well, I'm not young, but I'll take the coaching. So he said that real leaders thrive in an environment when they know that they are making it safer, that it is in fact safer because you are there. And I can unequivocally say that the way we are turning around the company is making it safer. It is, in fact, safer every single day than it was the day before. And I can see that because of our lean operating system. I can see the progress and the performance. Our Wildfire Command Center is a visual demonstration and a place where we gather to review our progress and what we need to do next and what we learned today and what we're going to do tomorrow. And that sense of progress fuels my energy. It gives me confidence that we're heading in the right direction. And I hope in time that your listeners, my customers, will know that they are safer because of our efforts. And that's an environment where a real leader can find great satisfaction and where I'm finding my purpose is being fulfilled in serving the people of California.
And we're going to dive into your vision for PG&E and investments, as well as overhauling a workflow when talking about that Wildfire Command Center in just a few moments. But I do want to give you an opportunity to talk about the settlements that were reached this year, $55 million for both the Dixie Fire and the 2019 Kincade Fire in Sonoma County, sparked by PG&E equipment. The settlements don't admit fault, but what do you want these civil settlements to represent?
Well, first and foremost, we've learned a lot about what it means to make it right. And in making it right, these settlements for me stood as an example of not just throwing money at it and hoping for the best, but rather, number one, getting restoration dollars to victims fast. So today, claimants are receiving an offer within 20 days of submitting their claim and receiving a payment within 47 days. That is a marked improvement over previous incidents. And we feel good about that because that allows people to get back on their feet. But it also, that settlement includes things like ongoing monitoring from an outside monitor to monitor that, in fact, in those six counties that we are doing what we said we were going to do. And I welcome that kind of transparency. I am not afraid to have people watch what we do because we're implementing this lean operating system. We have visual management that tells us on a daily basis. We have an operating review cadence and our heartbeat of improvement is alive and well. We know how we're doing. And so I'm not afraid for anyone to watch over our shoulder. I welcome the transparency. You know, we stand as a management team that catastrophic wildfires shall stop. That's a stand that this management team at PG&E has taken. And a settlement like this enables us to take additional steps beyond just our equipment and what we're going to do to prevent ignitions, but to help make our communities fire safe, understanding that lots of things can cause wildfire. Spread is a big part of the problem. Forest management and vegetation management having nothing to do with power lines is an area where we can be a big enabler. We know a lot. We've become very much experts in this area, and we feel very good about making our communities, our hometowns, safer through settlements like this. So I consider these settlements a real litmus test and maybe a signpost to the way that we can show up for our hometowns, taking accountability from the perspective of knowing that we have a role to make our communities safer in a variety of ways, and we're going to take the opportunity to do that.
A bill is sitting on the governor's desk that would protect ratepayers from their money being used in wildfire settlement agreements, both civil and criminal. The lawmaker used PG&E's pretrial settlement for the Dixie Fire as an example. That lawmaker says that the loophole exists, which prevents meaningful accountability because it can be offset on ratepayers. If it becomes law, then it would come from profits and shareholders. Where do you stand on this?
Yeah, I would just say that there are already in place a lot of rules that protect our customers from bearing the brunt of these incidents. And so our objective at all times is to make sure that we balance the needs of multiple stakeholders to address the recovery of funds for post-fire restitution and the settlements are funded through a variety of mechanisms, including things like insurance and other means. And so we also want to protect our customers from bearing undue costs in this construct. But we are working hard to make sure that our actions prevent the risk in the first place. And so our total focus on, again, is ending catastrophic wildfire, certainly caused by our equipment and keeping our customers safe.
I understand that this predates you, but where does the 2020 Zog fire stand? PG&E is facing criminal charges for the wildfire that killed four people.
Yeah, you know, the Zog fire, it did occur before I came. We continue to work through the settlements. In fact, most of the settlements are complete with victims for sure. And there's a variety for those four families. The settlements are complete. There are other longer term settlements that are in process, and we continue to work through that. But, you know, Vicki, I want to make it really understood by your listeners how serious this is to me. I wear on my blazer, whatever I'm wearing every day, I wear a little ladybug pin. And that pin is a reminder to me of Fela McLeod, who died in the Zog fire. She was an 8-year-old girl, and she and her mother died in their car trying to get out of the fire. I met with Fela and Elena's family. It was a heartbreaking day for me to see the firsthand devastation to a family unit in the loss of a family member in such a terrifying way. And it fuels me. I personally, and my entire team, get up every day to make sure that never happens again.
And I bring this up because when we're talking about settlements, I mean, that also follows the fire victim trust, and I've covered that a good amount. And the trusts, like civil settlements, are meant to accelerate payments for wildfire victims, as you just said. But the money from the trust hasn't been even entirely distributed, and that has been criticized from the beginning. And there's been criticism that half of the $13 billion or so is bound to stock values. And I bring this up because I covered the Camp Fire. I spoke with Camp Fire victims since ignition, and in the weeks, months, and in some cases years since, they're still rebuilding. Some are in RVs on plots of land. And in this instance, PG&E pled guilty to 84 counts of manslaughter. This is more than money for them. It is a sense of closure. How do you reconcile that?
Yeah, I'll start by saying it's as frustrating to us as it is to anyone that it takes so long. I will also say that, again, it is motivating to me to know that I can help victims more by turning this company around, because our interests are inextricably linked. I didn't come up with that construct. I'm a recipient of it. And so I'm not gonna assess whether it's good or bad, but I will say, given what it is, the best thing I can do for victims, since I'm not in charge of dispersing those funds, the best thing I can do for those victims is run PG&E extraordinarily well. Number one, prevent it from occurring again and regain the trust of investors who represent moms and pops, 401ks and retirement funds. That's who owns PG&E shares. That's who owns PG&E stock, not big Wall Street hedge funds. There were hedge funds involved at the bankruptcy, and they got their payday and they left. But who's left behind, the shareholders that we're talking about, are moms and pops whose life savings are in the form of PG&E stock through a retirement fund, what have you. The best thing I can do is gain the trust of other investors to invest more in PG&E, and that will increase the payout to both victims and those moms and pops who own the shares of our company. So I find that there's a strange symbiotic relationship between our shareholders and the victims, and both of them require that we run PG&E well. And so again, boils down to what can I do about all that? What I can do is regain the trust of my customers and regain the trust of people who would be making choices about where to invest their capital.
I want to give you an opportunity to respond to a report in Mercury News that as CEO, you took in more than $50 million last year, combination of salary, bonus, and stock value. I mean, that was more than double your predecessor, Bill Johnson.
Yeah, it's a little misleading, the headline, Vicki. So thank you for actually asking the question. I'd love to straighten out the facts here a little bit. There was a one-time payment for me taking the job that is reflected there that was money I had already earned because my previous company was very successful in delivering for customers, in finding this way of delivering for both shareholders and customers, those moms and pops who own the shares, plus the customers. Our success was real. That's why they wanted me to come to PG&E. And so that was a straight, direct one-for-one. I had already earned those dollars, but would forfeit if I left the company. The board of PG&E felt it was important to have an experienced, operating-minded executive. And so they had to make whole that payment that I had already received from my previous employer. So that was the mass, that was the majority, more than the majority of that 1 year payment. My annual salary going forward is very much in line with my peers across the industry.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. If you're just joining us, we're revisiting my conversation with PG&E CEO, Patti Poppe. We'll have more in a couple minutes. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. If you're just joining us, we're going to continue my conversation with PG&E CEO Patti Poppe. I spoke with Poppe back in August about leading the largest utility company in the country. We talked about the deadly disasters and scandals Poppe inherited. Now, we're going to focus on PG&E's size, as well as how Poppe plans to rebuild trust by making PG&E safer. You're talking about a footprint that extends from the Oregon border, you know, Bernie Falls down through Bakersfield. That's 70,000 square miles. You have 16 million people that you serve. That's roughly 40% of the state's population. What do you say to the argument that there is such a thing as too big, that time and time again, we see that one company isn't suitable for 16 million people and perhaps breaking up the utility company?
Yeah, Vicki, it's a great question. In fact, I might have been someone before I came who said PG&E was too big, that it's hard to be close to your local communities, and which is why, as soon as I got here, we broke the company into five regions. So our regional service model is specifically designed to address that question, Vicki. It is important for us to be connected to our local communities. And I'm just happy to say that I can feel the fruits of those regional relationships already. I get calls from my regional vice presidents who are my representative in each of our regions daily. I know what's happening in those regions, and we have a much closer relationship to our local hometowns. And so we've designed a purpose here at PG&E, the new leadership team that I've been able to recruit and hire from across the country, experienced utility executives who are all here making it right and making it safe. We've taken a stand and defined our purpose as delivering for our hometowns, serving our planet, and leading with love. Now, that may sound like a different kind of PG&E, but I think we need a different kind of PG&E. And so the winds of change are definitely blowing inside PG&E, and we're changing the culture. And remember, always equal balance of head and heart. Our heads in our process and improving the systems and improving the way we deliver our work in a way that is heart-driven, heart-led, leading with love means that we love our customers, we love our coworkers, and we make an environment where we can be our best and have people actually feel that they are being served by their hometown utility. That's our ambition, and that's what we're out to do.
When creating that framework to lead as the CEO of PG&E, is there a gold standard across the country that you look towards? Because you said you led with that, you know, utility companies can be kind of tight-knit.
Yeah, there are definitely best in breed utilities who have strong performance. It's very transparent. So for example, our chief customer officer, Marlene Santos, joined us from NextEra, which she worked actually at one of their subsidiaries, Florida Power and Light, which by all accounts is one of the best run utilities in the nation. She worked at FPL for 39 years. She learned that hurricanes, for example, as a real weather and damaging sort of a weather event that affects electric infrastructure can be overcome with the right kind of infrastructure. So she comes with this experience that they rebuilt their electric infrastructure to withstand the effects of hurricanes, just like we are undergrounding our electric infrastructure to prevent outages like that big winter storm that we experienced this year and wildfire. I call this climate resilient infrastructure. So that's one of the best practices that we're deploying, that you actually have to engineer your infrastructure, not for today's climate, but for future climate.
Well, let's look at some of the improvements that have been made. I mean, there are public safety power shutoffs that have impacted millions of customers at times for days on end in recent years, which can be a health risk as well as just a huge financial cost, let alone an inconvenience. What improvements have been made?
So first, I'll just talk about how many customers are affected by PSPS. So back in 2019, over 2 million customers experienced a PSPS event. March forward to 2020, we got that down to 600,000. 2021, last year, we had just over 80,000 customers. So 2 million, 600,000, 80,000. That's a huge dramatic improvement. And there's a lot of things that we've done to minimize the customers impacted by each and every one of those events. And we've improved the algorithm so that it is more pinpointed. We've improved the technology and the data that we have on fuel moisture levels, wind speeds, terrain. And so we can see the exact conditions when we call a PSPS and can be much more targeted, and we can restore them much faster because of the way that we've re-engineered the system. So we are definitely feeling the benefits of knowledge and experience and time and improved visibility about how we operate the system.
What's it going to take to say goodbye to shutoffs?
Undergrounding 10,000 miles of line.
Well, let's get to that.
Why?
I toured one of those projects in the footprint of the Caldor Fire in El Dorado County in the Grizzly Flats community. And that will be a total of 9 miles completed by the end of the year. But that's really just a sliver of the overall 10,000 mile commitment that you made across PG&E's high fire threat areas in the years to come. Can you explain the benefits of undergrounding?
Yeah, so it's multifold. But first, it makes the system safer. Number one, full stop. It's the best risk mitigant that there is to get the lines out of the hazard zones, you know? So that's thing one. Thing two, it's actually more cost effective. And people often ask me about the price. And I have to admit that for many years, the company defended that undergrounding was too expensive, though people were begging them to underground the lines. When you look at the math through the lens of a risk cost per dollar, if you will, or some, you know, something in that framework, you can see that the ongoing maintenance that we would have to do to maintain the vegetation and rebuild the power lines above the ground actually ends up costing the same as the investment to be made in undergrounding. And we can spread the cost of undergrounding out over many years. So an annual cost to a customer can actually be beneficial with the trade, at a minimum flat, and in some cases beneficial, lowering the cost. And certainly when you factor in the cost of outages, whether it's PSPS or just a weather event, or the cost of fire, that is no comparison, that is too expensive not to underground. So when you do the math through that lens, it's pretty easy to show that there's an economic case, you can do math, and it actually is economically more viable to underground the lines than to continue to use that risk mitigant year after year after year after year.
If undergrounding is the solution, though, to power public safety power shutoffs and, of course, catastrophic wildfires, is this catch up? Because, you know, your neighbor to the south, San Diego Gas and Electric, has buried more than 10,000 miles of power lines. I understand that this precedes you, but what do you think took PG&E so long?
It's hard to understand. I don't know. And I, you know, Vicki, as tempting as it is, and I sometimes try and imagine, it really doesn't serve me well to spend much time thinking about why things didn't happen before. All I can spend time thinking about is what we're going to do today, tomorrow, and the next to make this system safer. So that's really where I spend my time.
Many of the areas in the next year are going to be in our listening area, from Butte County, Amador, Calaveras, Nevada, Placer, and that's just naming a few. When I was looking at the construction, you know, trenches that are 3 feet deep, they're backfilled, then conduit, cable, pulled through. It's loud, and admittedly, it is disruptive. And there were some instances that customers in the Grizzly Flats area got a little heated. How do you want customers to prepare for what's to come?
Well, first of all, I want all of our customers and your listeners, Vicki, to know that we continue every day to work to make it less disruptive. You know, some of these early communities are, you know, on the cutting edge, and we don't yet have the most modern and advanced equipment yet, but that will change as we move forward with our long-term plan. I was able to go to a project myself. I've been to many of them, but one of the ones that I was pretty excited about was using boring. And in fact, part of that Caldor fire footprint where you were is going to be bored instead of trenched, which means the conduit can be drawn without removing dirt. It's more environmentally friendly. There's certain conditions where that works. There's certain conditions where it doesn't. I was on a job also in El Dorado County one day, and I was asking the equipment provider if this was their best equipment. He said, "Oh, heck no, this is some of my old stuff." I said, "Well, where's your best stuff? How come it's not here on this job?" He said, "Because you're not doing enough miles, Patty. When you do more miles, I can justify bringing my equipment." So when we get up to scale, like next year when we're planning, well, this year we're doing 175 miles, for example. Next year we plan to do 400 and then 800. As we ramp up to 1,000 or more miles a year, that is what justifies the best equipment. We can get the best equipment. We can actually build a workforce in these local communities. I can't wait to have a Placer workforce, you know, serving Placer and Grizzly Flats workforce serving Grizzly Flats. There's such an opportunity for us to create local jobs, local prosperity while we make our communities safer. That's the role of a great utility. That's the PG&E I want your listeners to imagine as their hometown utility. And so as we say, we're rebuilding it from the underground up. That's what we mean. We're not just rebuilding the infrastructure. We're rebuilding the culture of PG&E to have the fullest respect and admiration and love for our customers and our hometowns.
As undergrounding is scaling up, there's also changes in buildings with the way you operate. I visited your facility in San Ramon. There's a weekly wildfire risk command center meeting that takes place. And this started with you as CEO last year. And I kind of looked at it as a workflow that is visual and collaborative as opposed to more traditional and siloed, divvied up by department heads. How did you create this?
Yeah, this is straight out of our lean playbook. Great operations, and I've been doing operations my entire career. I started in automotive and then switched to utilities halfway through, and deploying the best of the best of a lean operating system. And we've learned over the year and a half now that making our progress visible, making our commitments visible is a very important part. But if management does not have an operating review cadence, if we're not there routinely, if we're not executing that heartbeat in the what's called the plan, do, check, act cycle, then we just leave it to chance. We're not leaving it to chance at PG&E anymore.
We also talked about developing bidirectional charging and by partnering with the automotive industry, General Motors specifically. Essentially, electricity goes two ways. You power a car and then you take the energy stored and discharge it back into the grid. Where are you in this process? And is this being done elsewhere?
Yeah, it's so exciting. I'm so glad you asked about this, Vicki. Now, I'll just tell you a quick little story. I was driving around. I was actually up in the Feather River Canyon. And in that canyon, we have obviously these huge transmission lines and power lines. And I looked I was up actually on this bluff looking at the transmission lines. And I thought to myself, you know, when these lines were first set, they were a pathway to prosperity. This was electrifying our rural communities, bringing the ability to mechanize our agriculture, to have power to homes, a modern society to the rural communities of California. And at the time when they were set, the shortest distance between two points made the most sense, but today it doesn't. And so we not only have the obligation in the name of safety and resilience, we have the opportunity to reimagine this grid. If Thomas Edison visited to me and walked into one of our substations, he would recognize most of the stuff, I like to say, but not for long, not for long. So bi-directional charging electric vehicles is one example of a distributed energy resource that obviously, number one, electric vehicles decarbonize transportation, the number one carbon emitter. That's fantastic progress. But when you layer on the idea of maybe during a PSPS, or if there's a winter storm, your car being able to power your home, like the Ford Lightning as advertised, that is an added benefit of that electrification of transportation. But then you layer on a peak summer day, like the one we had last week, where we have flex alerts, imagine that very same truck putting power back to the grid, shaving the peak, and eliminating the whole concept of flex alerts because it's all automated. We'd have artificial intelligence that's optimizing distributed energy resources. That's the energy system of the future that we're going to build here at PG&E. And as a result, we've signed two arrangements. We've got two agreements with Ford and one with General Motors, where the bi-directional vehicles will be powered by the PG&E grid first, will be first in the world to have that technology deployed commercially. And super excited about our partnerships with both Ford and GM, and they're pressing their own teams to move faster to make that a reality here in Northern and Central California.
Finally, what is your confidence level PG&E equipment won't be connected to a massive wildfire?
That's our stand to end a catastrophic wildfire. We've seen great progress so far this year. In fact, I was just talking this morning to a couple of my emergency response crews, former firefighters that now work for PG&E. We've got a whole crew of them, about 80 plus former firefighters work with PG&E. They're PG&E employees to make sure that we can respond when fires are happening, not to fight the fires, but to protect our assets and do all the preventative work that they learned in their previous years and help us identify risks on our system. But I was just talking to those guys this morning, and they were sharing with me that, you know, the response has been great. I couldn't be more thankful for Cal Fire and our local fire departments, U.S. Forest Service, for their incredible work. But that combined with ignitions down is making a big difference here in California and some of the worst drought conditions that have been seen. We've had more what we call R3 days that are precursors to red flag warning days this year than any other year before. The performance has been dramatically better. So we feel more and more optimistic every day, but we still are finding more areas of improvement every day. Our engineers are scouring our system and utilizing our inspection data and our vegetation management data to make the next and best repair to the system. And so we know to date, we've reduced about 90% of the risk on our system. We're very proud of that progress. The layers of protection that yield that 90% are a big deal for people, but that leaves 10% risk remaining. And so we're not going to rest until we're at 100%. And that's certainly top of mind for us and what we're working on every single day.
Patty, thank you for joining us and taking the time.
Thank you so much, Vicki. It's so great to be with you. I look forward to talking to you again sometime.
That's my conversation with PG&E CEO Patty Poppe, which first aired back in August. Still ahead, a Central Valley native has made American League history. We'll learn about New York Yankee Aaron Judge's home run journey, which began in the small town of Linden. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Music.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're closing a special best of hour with a Major League Baseball story with Central Valley roots. New York Yankee superstar Aaron Judge achieved something which hasn't been done in baseball in more than six decades. The 30-year-old slugger from San Joaquin County surpassed an American League record set by fellow Yankee Roger Maris back in 1961, hitting 62 home runs this season. But Aaron's pursuit of baseball glory begins in his hometown of Linden, a small community just east of Stockton. Craig Anderson is a writer and covered high school sports for the Linden Herald for 25 years, including when Aaron was a three-sport star at Linden High. I spoke with Craig back in September when Aaron then tied the home run record, and just a few days after our conversation, officially made baseball history. You know, I can't tell you really, our conversation now, the timing of it is kind of like kismet, given last night's game. And I couldn't help but see you smile when kind of replaying that moment in history that was made last night. How did it make you feel?
Relief, for one thing, because the pressure has been on for quite a while, really ever since he was a rookie and set the rookie home run record. And so this was great, kind of take the burden off of his shoulders. But Aaron's always been a guy who could handle that sort of thing. He had the right attitude. He had the knowledge to know what he was doing. And I don't think anything really bothered him. He was kind of frustrated when he got injured a few times. But, you know, he knew he was coming back. And he's always been a really level-headed guy, as far as I know.
You've really been able to follow his trajectory from, you know, a high school athlete to what he's accomplishing now. When you covered him as a kid from a small Central Valley farming town, were there any hints that one day you would be taking this in?
I think so, because he was like, in all of the sports that he did, the nice thing about what it was that he did was he understood the sport. He understood the nuances. He understood the details of football, basketball, baseball. And so he was such a student of every game that he did. I thought that if he ever made it to the majors, he'd be okay, because he was a student of the game, whatever game it was he was playing. And as a track coach there for 31 years, I kept begging Robert Ammerman, his baseball coach, let me just have him for a couple of days, you know, long jump, triple jump. He's fantastic. He's big. He's strong. He's got hops, you know. And RA would always say, no, sorry, he'd get injured. I said, oh, okay, sliding into home plate head first, that's right. Not going to get him injured. You
know? Yeah, exactly.
So we had a friendly argument about that for 4 years.
Well, given that he grew up in Linden and you were a sports coach as well, I mean, that's a small town, roughly 2,000 people in San Joaquin County. Just paint a picture for us, for those of us who haven't made the trip.
Linden, to me, has always been the epitome of small-town high school sports. When I go to cover the football games and or coach soccer, which I did for a few years, as well as track, when you show up at Lions Stadium, you walk into one end of it, and up above as the sun's going down, there's a sunset up in the sky. The fans are there. The grass is green. It's high school football, high school soccer, whatever it is, sport in the gym. At its best, it's like Friday Night Lights without all the angst, I think. So that, to me, it's the epitome of small-town football, basketball, track and field, you know, baseball, whatever sport. And I really found that to be intriguing and kind of a wonderful feeling to be in that environment for so long.
I can only imagine the amount of celebration and support that the Linden community has had for Aaron Judge, not only, you know, last night, but for his entire career, you know, in Major League Baseball.
Sure. Everybody, there would be buses when you play the A's, you know, a bunch of buses, off they go to the games. And I've said in various venues around the country and around the state, you know, where are you from? I'm from Linden. Oh, wait, Aaron Judge is from Linden. It's like, well, yeah, he is, you know. It's not surprising, though. He's the natural of baseball of today,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. And understandably, a lot of pride. You got to know him as a person, I guess, outside of the field. What stood out to you about him? Who was he?
First of all, he's very intelligent. He's very knowledgeable about his place in life and in sport. I don't think anything really overwhelms him that much because the Yankees did a good thing. They kept him in the majors for a couple, the minor leagues for a couple of years. So he went to all these odd places on the East Coast and Nova Scotia and, you know, places like that. So he learned what the game was all about at that level. And so when he was ready, they brought him up. And I think that was very smart on their part. It helped him. It helped the team. And he met a lot of his future teammates down there in the minors as well. But because he knows the game that he plays so well, I don't think anything surprises him. Mm. He's very, very level-headed and calm. And I call him the equivalent of the Linden's Fred Biletnikoff in football, because Freddie was a great receiver for the Oakland Raiders back in the day, Hall of Famer and all that. But he wouldn't just run patterns of football. He'd put little things into the pattern that would completely freak out the defensive backs.
You know?
And he would more often than not be all alone running down the field because of that. So I think he's doing the same thing in baseball.
You know, given that he started in the minor leagues, but he also, I believe, had an opportunity to go to the Oakland A's out of high school, he chose to go to Fresno State instead. I mean, to me, that kind of exemplifies a sort of like humility. I mean, I guess, how do you think that shaped, you know, the way he plays the game? And if he comes back home, you know, to Linden, I don't know if he does, you know, kind of like how he supports the town where he grew up in.
He has gotten great support from the town, but he also started a foundation for helping kids in Linden and in the Linden area. He told me he just wanted to go to college. I thought that'd be a great thing to do, besides which Fresno State is a powerhouse in collegiate baseball. And I think I can't remember if they, when he was there, just before he got there, they had won the collegiate championship. So he wanted to go to a powerhouse program where he could learn about the big aspects of baseball, which he did. And I think that really helped him when he went into the minors. So he's, you know, he plans things out. He knows what he's doing. He's not some country hick, that's for sure. Although everybody that I told I was going to be on this program today, they said, make sure he's from Linden, not Northern California, not Sacramento.
Yeah,
he's
yeah.
from Linden. I said, don't worry, I'll make sure that everybody knows he's from Linden.
Linden, Linden, Linden. Linden.
And he does come back. And he came back for his induction into the Linden Athletic Hall of Fame, which is a great event. And we were able to talk backstage before he went out and gave his speech, myself, him, and a couple other guys, a couple of his pals from Linden and stuff. And we were just laughing and having a great time. It was fun talking to him because he's just the same guy that he's always been.
And I completely understand Linden making sure to claim him and all the pride that goes with that.
Yeah.
I also, it struck me these parallels that kind of happened because, I mean, there's three Yankees total. I mean, Aaron passed Yankee legend Babe Ruth to get to 61 home runs, currently tied with Roger Maris, who is also a Yankee, now at 61. But Roger Maris hit his 61st home run on October 1st, 1961.
Mm-hmm.
So that's almost, you know, exactly to the day 61 years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of 61s here. Not that it was planned, but it was just something that struck me.
It's strange how that works out. One thing I know that I remember Roger Maris is being old enough to follow that back in the day, and he was like a nervous wreck by the time he finally hit that 61st. His hair was falling out, and he had a nervous stomach, and he was throwing up before games and all this. And everybody said, well, it would have been better maybe if Mickey Mantle had done this because he was more used to all this pressure and Roger Maris wasn't. But seemingly, none of that has affected Aaron. He's just going out there and having fun playing baseball no matter what the pressure, no matter what the situation. And people may forget, he is a great defensive player. You know, very few balls get past that guy in center field. Now he's playing in center. And I think that should be noted, too. He is a true Triple Crown kind of a guy, not only in the things that established the Triple Crown, but also the nuances of defense. He knows how to position himself in the field and play good defense. So he is truly an all-around guy, as far as I'm concerned.
And I believe when he hit that home run last night, you know, rounding the bases, he pointed at his mother. And, you know, Patty and Wayne, they adopted Aaron right. the day he was born in April of 1992. And last night he said, I would be nothing without my family. I mean, that's a tremendous amount of love and guidance that he recognizes and shaped, you know, the person and not only the player, but the person that he is today.
Oh, I agree. And as an adoptive parent myself, one of my sons is adopted. I fully identify with his situation because it's never, oh, you're an adopted guy. No, it's you're my child, and that's it. And you're supportive 100%. And Wayne and Patty are just the greatest parents. You know, Wayne is always, every time I see him, he'd make a joke or do something. And he coached basketball at Linden for a couple of years, and he's a great guy, and so is she. They're just great mm-hmm. parents, and his brother's great too. So he came from a solid family, and that's probably helped him endure all this stuff that's going on in New York in sports.
Craig, thank you so much for joining us and giving us just more light into who Aaron Judge is.
He's a fun guy. He's funny. He's intelligent. And he's a heck of a baseball player.
That's for sure. That's my conversation with Craig Anderson discussing New York Yankee Aaron Judge and what his historic home run season means for his hometown of Linden in the Central Valley. Our conversation first aired when Aaron tied the record back in September, and just a few days later, he went on to break the record and make American League Baseball history. Aaron was also named MVP of the American League in November. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.